Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the podcast from the magazine whose spaceship design will be even more not safe for work than Jeff Bezos's. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hello, space cowboys.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We're going to let Catherine go squee here in a moment. But first, data privacy is now finally in your hands. Introducing Secure, the Swiss-hosted instant messaging and email platform. Trusted by privacy advocates across the globe, featuring 100% proprietary technology with no affiliation with big tech companies like Amazon, Google, or Microsoft, your data is now completely in your own hands. Make the move to Secure by visiting secure.com. That is SEKUR.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. So this morning on Twitter, Jen Monroe, a.k.a. Jen the Libertarian, wrote that, quote, Catherine Mangue Ward gets to talk about rockets on the Reason Pod and everyone has to let her because it's an important news story, unquote. So, Catherine, what did Richard Branson do this weekend and why is it important?
I want to just pause and offer like the very sober and sincere reflection here, which is, woohoo!
Yeah, I see.
We are about to get bogged down in a bunch of sort of grumpy meta commentary about the fact that this weekend, billionaire Richard Branson went up to the very, very edge of space, depending on who you believe about where the edge of space is, and was weightless for a minute. Apparently,
yeah, he's
according
like
to
a
the
fake space bro,
he's a, you know, fake space. He identifies as a space bro, and that's what matters. And Jeff Bezos is going to do the same, but a little higher in a rocket that looks absolutely 100% like a penis a little bit later this week. And, you know,
isn't
I just
that true
say,
of all rockets?
No, but really, really, the Blue Origin rocket is...
Yeah, not the one that Branson was in, Peter.
Like, you would have to...
If that looks like your penis, see your doctor now.
Yeah, no. Spaceship Two does not look like a penis. Bezos is definitely does. Like, you would have to, like, pixelate that thing, like, on Japanese TV. It's a lot. But I just, like, it's so exciting that we are in a moment. Like, this week, multiple companies are just casually sending stuff into space. And, like, thank God, it is about time. This really, like, fulfills the squandered promise, both of the original space race and then of my enthusiasm of the last decade, where, like, any minute now, definitely there were going to be tickets to buy on rockets, but it took a long time. Let's do some meta commentary. I will kick us off by just noting that people are pretty peeved that Branson and Bezos and Musk are using their money to do space. And they have all these ideas about other stuff that money should be being spent on. I think this is pretty, it's a weird inversion because a lot of the things that they say that money should be being spent on, it is also being spent on that. Like, these guys do a lot of charity. They do medical charity. They do poverty alleviation. Like, the idea that somehow it's like just space today because people, I don't know, have the attention span of fruit flies, I guess, is bizarre. But also, when NASA takes regular people's money, like takes poor people's money and uses it to do exactly the same thing, it's like everyone loved that. Everyone's super excited about that. Like, why are people mad that the billionaire money is being used for space and not being mad that their money is being used for space? I will never understand. So let's just start there with the rage. I have a lot more to say.
I will circle back to Catherine about some elements of that, but let's take her rage and hand the baton of disquiet, of exhaustion to Nick Gillespie. Nick, your favorite columnist, Mike Barnacle, tweeted
Mike
that,
Barnacle, he's in quotes, right? Because he's a character that we've all invented. He's that guy at the end of the bar who gives you the quote you need when you're on deadline. Mike
he's
Barnacle.
He's a finely drawn character, Nick Gillespie.
You know, and he has the wisdom of the common man because he sometimes sees them from his limousines.
Barnacle tweets out, Branson took his rocket ride. Bezos and his rocket is next. Both of these self-indulgent billionaires with their own rockets make the strongest case yet for hiking taxes on the super rich.
Yeah. Mika are behind that one, too, because, you know, they're not super rich. I just want to point out, and this is where my rage goes, Matt, I'm exhausted by the fact that people aren't acknowledging this is by a major gap, the second most risky and provocative thing that Richard Branson has done. And of course, the first thing was actually signing the Sex Pistols after they had lost all their contracts with every major label in England. And he's the one who brought Nevermind the Bollocks to the masses. So, you know, that's when he was in the heart of a distant sun, Matt Welch.
I guess Jeff Bezos didn't get the Nevermind the Bollocks memo.
Yeah, no. Well, Bezos has done a couple of things, you know. But
Bezos is spending $1 billion to bring Lord of the Rings to television.
Nobody's mad at him about that.
Yeah, they will be once it starts clogging the internet, which is more expensive than ever, of course, or so we're told. But Matt, and to follow up on what Catherine's talking about, it is bizarre to me that, and actually it's not, it's totally predictable that as we get to a point where this has the potential, and it's cool in and of itself because it's not costing me anything. It's not costing any of us anything, right? If Richard Branson wants to blow himself up in outer space or near outer space or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. But this could be the next step in like just a really fascinating world. And the way I was thinking about this, you know, when the internet, you know, started emerging as a mass medium in the early 90s, it was super exciting and weird and wonderful. And I have that sense of this, like where, you know, we are actually doing it. This is a vision that has been around for 100 years of starting to get into outer space. And whether it is, you know, just space tourism or if it leads to something else, this is incredible. I mean, and it's, you know, when you see the pictures, and I think Branson's, you know, his little video about, you know, like that he dreamed of doing this his entire life. And, you know, and now it's like, you know, imagine what the young people who have their lives in front of them are going to be doing. You know, that's like pretty freaking great. And we shouldn't let the, you know, the naysayers and the Mike Barnacles of the world, the multiple, you know, recidivist plagiarists and liars and bullshit artists harsh, you know, something beautiful.
Before we leave Barnacle, and this will sort of transfer into policy, Peter, last night when I tweeted some WTF-ery in the general direction of La Barnacle, someone came back to me and tweeted, the government does these things less and less well because Congress strangled the public capacity for innovation at behest of its corporate masters. It's not magic private sector fairy dust. It's backroom deals. Therefore, tax the rich. What's wrong with that analysis of the way that government spends money to go to space?
What? Congress's corporate pay? Like, what in the world? It's incoherent, for one thing. And also, it's just wrong about whether or not the government does this stuff really well ever. And this goes back more than 100 years, actually, to the beginnings of spaceflight. So I was refreshing myself on some Wright Brothers history this morning.
Like you do, right?
So I went to school, to elementary school in North Carolina for a few years. And of course, you learn a lot about first in flight. I was, you know, modestly obsessed with the Wright Brothers as a kid. But I had forgotten that the Wright Brothers, after having done some of their first successful tests and sort of getting out ahead of a lot of the other flight innovators of their day, they showed this to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government was like, "What? No, we're not. You guys are just a couple of bicycle dorks from Ohio. What in the world?" And what the U.S. government had done in the meantime was to spend $50,000 on the Langley Aerodrome. And the Langley Aerodrome was like the product of a huge amount of money and technical expertise. They brought in the best and they built this giant thing. And you know what it did? It dropped like a rock into the ocean. It didn't fly. And instead, a couple of bicycle dorks from Ohio figured out how to fly and built commercial aviation and sort of the whole technology around flight that we now think of today. Their control schemes are still basically the control schemes that we use in airplanes. And so to get mad at private innovators for doing stuff that is, it's totally like Jeff Bezos and Branson are doing this because they're billionaires and they can, and it's fun. And if I was a billionaire, maybe I would too. But these things also have, as Nick was saying, they're quite likely to provide real social value and to change the way that we live. Maybe not the way that we live, but the way that the next generation or generations after that does. But maybe even, I mean, you can imagine significant commercial spaceflight industries existing in 20 or 30 years within our lifetimes and just radically changing the shape of the shape and scope of sort of where humans can go and how they can move stuff around and what they can do. And this seems like a great, exciting first step. And I'm excited to see what the next ones are.
You know, Branson is also just fascinating. He's like 70 years old. And, you know, he has made a bunch of records, both as a balloonist and as like a boat guy, a speedboat guy. He is a seriously wonderful speed freak and just, you know, serial innovator, even more than an entrepreneur. His stuff, his companies fail as often as they succeed. But he's, you know, he's a good guy. He's like a great, I mean, I think Jeff Bezos is too, you know, overall. I mean, people like Elon Musk are a little bit, you know, they're kind of trollish in a way. But, you know, Branson is like, he's just
Musk
fantastic.
Is also, though. Musk has also gotten further in the development of these rockets. Like his company is further along, and Branson and Bezos
I'm
are
just
chasing
saying,
Musk's
Branson. Branson is the, you know, like what's wrong with Richard Branson? He gives tons of money away to all sorts of causes, good and bad. He builds businesses, and he, you know, I mean, for God's sake, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have Tubular Bells. Which was the first release on Virgin Records and was like phenomenal. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's still around, you know, like it was a game changer. It's in the background everywhere, not just The Exorcist. So kudos to Richard Branson.
Since Peter brought up Kitty Hawk, just a shout out. I was down there a few months ago with some hardcore Reason subscribers, David Deal, shout out to you. Visited the Kitty Hawk Museum. I highly recommend it. It's really fun. Catherine, tell us in practical terms, what is the significance of this weekend? What happened? What does it mean? What was the breakthrough, if any? You've been looking at this for the last 20 years, 15 years. So what was the thing?
In practical terms, this weekend actually wasn't that significant. Like, it was extremely woohoo, but the technology that Branson used is not, it is sort of minor improvements on the same technology that won him the XPRIZE all those years ago with Burt Rutan's design. They did not go higher or do more, but this was, in some sense, the first, first incident of space tourism. I think that's like the landmark that we hit. And the Bezos flight similarly will contain not just Bezos, but also another passenger who is, you know, sort of a civilian. Actually, it's a cool story. It's like this female astronaut gal who didn't end up getting to go to space and is super old. Anyway, there's some interesting kind of like, it's the space equivalent of the people that you bring to the State of the Union speech and like point at them. You know, there's like some of those people popping up, which is, they're all good stories. But this flight this weekend only matters because it signals that we are kind of entering the tourism phase of space. And I do think that we really are now. There are, you know, many, many people who have paid for tickets already on the Virgin Galactic craft. And now that Branson has flown on it and has returned safely, those people will be like looking to cash those tickets in. And, you know, Bezos, likewise, he is sort of doing a more of a hybrid model where he's looking for a commercial as well as tourism applications. And of course, Musk. Musk actually had bought a ticket on Branson's craft, which is a great example.
But he got bumped.
He didn't get the first flight. He didn't buy a ticket on the first flight. But yeah, you know, he was on standby. He was like hoping to get on the flight.
He's trying to use
we're
his
looking
upgrades.
For one billionaire who can change his plans, and we're going to give you a voucher for a meal.
That's right. It's you can stay in the Super 8 tonight on Branson's dime if you want to wait. No, but I think
you can't buy tickets for the first flight if you're using points.
Yeah. So, the thing that's new here is like this is the promised democratization. Like that's what's starting right now. It's not
a phrase that he used over and over again yesterday, which right. I loved. It's the democratization.
And that's always been Branson's main emphasis. That truly has he just wants to bring space flight to the people because it's cool, and that's Branson's whole career. He wants to bring X to the people because it's cool. And I think that there is this weird zero-sum thinking that's going on around all of this in two ways. One, I think people are confused and they sort of somehow think that like Bezos and Branson and Musk are each going to build like one spaceship, fill it with all their gold, and then like fly away cackling or something, like super villains. And that is very much not the idea that any of them are pursuing. They're going to be selling tickets. They're going to be using the rockets for science and humanitarian causes and building on existing technology to build better technology. This is not a case where they are billionaires who are doing a thing that only they will enjoy. It is a classic case of billionaires who are doing a thing that hopefully pretty soon we will also be able to enjoy. And the analogy to, which you guys mentioned, to commercial air travel is a really solid one. And there's no reason to think, unless the government intervenes and screws it all up, which it mercifully avoided doing in the case of commercial air travel, there's no reason to think that it will go any differently in this case.
Nick, Catherine, name checked Burt Rutan, part of the joy.
The Elvis of aerospace.
The joy of being the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine is has always been this great little subgenre of private space travel enthusiasts. Do you care to share any just random memory out of a hat of moments at various Reason weekends or presentations of our private space travel buddies doing a thing?
Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, once spoke at a Reason event. And the greatest thing about it was he had a promotional video that he showed before he took the stage. And it was just like, ladies and gentlemen, Buzz Aldrin. And then it was like this, 5-minute documentary about Buzz Aldrin. And it was like, Buzz Aldrin was born a very small baby and grew up to be the second man on the moon. And like, it goes through all of his highlights. And then it was like, Buzz Aldrin is in the winner's circle. And then it was like Buzz starts talking, and the implication was like, he's in the winner's circle. You in the audience, you're in the loser's circle.
And that literally everyone on Earth is, right? Like the winner's circle.
Yeah, there's like eight
the
people.
The Venn diagram of
people.
Earth
yeah.
and the winner's circle like
the winner's
doesn't
circle,
overlap.
Loser's circle. And it's like, okay, well, at least we have a lot of company out here. But so that I always think about. And the way that Buzz, even if it like will break his elbows, he'll punch anybody in the face who says that the moon landing was fake, which, yeah. Why is he so defensive? You would think he would be a little more secure in that if it was real. But the other thing is Burt Rutan once gave a talk at a Reason conference or event, and he talked about how it was, I don't know if it was one of the Mercury capsules or something, but that they landed in the Pacific, and then they would take them on a tour back towards the Smithsonian, basically, across the country, and they would stop in small towns, and that all that Rutan saw that, like in his town somewhere, it's like he's from Iowa or somewhere in the heartland in the Plain States, and he said, you got to touch the capsule that had been in space, and that it was unbelievably, inspiring for him. And the way he talked about that, and it wasn't this kind of, weirdo, like, autistic engineer type of thing. It was like, that fired up his imagination in a way that led to, Rutan just creating, an endless procession of like super innovative spacecraft and aircraft and things like that. And, that was deeply moving.
And that story, the story of I saw something from the kind of golden age of space, from the Apollo program, from whatever it was, and that inspired me to become an aerospace engineer. Like that story is universal. Anyone who works in the business who is above a certain age has that story. And we are now past the generation that can have that story. Like we, like people who might have the sort of interest and aptitude to do space right now, have there's been a kind of interregnum, or we have not had a kind of formative, inspiring space moment until this last year, when we had the successful Falcon launch, which took the folks in the Dragon capsule up to the ISS. And now, you know, a lively space race full of colorful billionaire personalities competing for who is going to do the coolest space thing. Like, that's going to draw smart, talented people back to work on the space problem. And that is how you get innovation. That is how you get stuff that's going to benefit everyone. And I think, you know, similar to the internet, which Nick referenced, you know, you can say this is a weirdo thing that only fancy people with their fancy computers at a university can do. You know, it's not relevant to my life. But once there's a little glimmer of something cool and exciting, people are drawn to it and then everyone benefits. You know, this space race is going to be entangled with the state. Like, there is going to be no way to fully describe this as a private activity. There will be people who, with much justification, are going to say, well, they still got government money. Like, you didn't build that. You know, like, all of that is going to happen, and that is going to be true. But, like, I hope that we can remember the desperate, pathetic state of the U.S. space program before Musk's success in particular, but also Branson's and now Bezos's. Like, we had lost the ability to do space from a state perspective. And later on, when people somehow say, like, no, actually, the government did this, they were involved, but the government didn't do this. If this batch of space race takes off and people really get to go to space, like, screw the people that 10 years from now are going to be like, well, it was really still a government invention. No, it wasn't.
The kind of interregnum thing and the rekindling of all of that is felt very deeply where I'm from. Long Beach, California, South Bay, California was the aerospace belt, like the center of it. And it's been fun to interact with, you know, my home crowd there. There's a renewed sense of pride. They're all pumped up that SpaceX is starting to take over some former aerospace facilities. I think they might even be going into the Long Beach Airport area, which, you know, used to have McDonnell Douglas, which, you know, had 90,000 employees and now has two. But like, they're starting to rehabilitate that. There's a regional space pride happening. Like, we're back, baby, in that broad area. And I kind of love it. Kind of love it. Not going to lie. Let's shift gears for a kind of a quickish round, if we can.
No, I'm afraid that's not possible, Matt. A quick round? No.
We'll see. President Joe Biden, still the president, last week signed an executive order on promoting competition in the American economy. Among the 72 or so measures within the order, he wants to reimpose, it's a lot of like statements of aspiration, really, wants to reimpose net neutrality rules, wants to create a nutrition label for internet services. I have no idea what that means. It's going to import cheaper drugs from Canada.
Why are we pretending that that's anything other than like a perfect kind of mapping of his brain where it's just like he's got Alzheimer's?
Come on.
You know, he doesn't know what he's saying.
Come on, man. They want to do Made in America stickers easier for farmers and such. Like, the White House in their press release for this says this is decisive action to reduce the trend of corporate consolidation. Peter, do you, in fact, have to hand it to Joe Biden?
Nope.
Not gonna.
I don't. I mean, maybe someone else has to hand it to Joe Biden. Maybe there's a guy who just has to, he says, give me a Diet Coke. And that guy has to hand him a Diet Coke. But not me. No, all of this, look, the primary way that to think about this is that this is part of the Biden administration specifically and the political left's war on bigness. And they just have decided that big things, so that's people, that's big corporations, big billionaires, big things that aren't government, all the big things that aren't government are bad. And so that is the prevailing kind of wisdom at the FTC right now, where we now have a trust buster, Lina Khan, as the who has just been brought in and appointed not only a member of the FTC, but the chair. That's Tim Wu, who has been brought in as one of Biden's top econ advisors. They've all basically just decided that large corporations and companies that sort of have a lot of control of something, and it's always right, like, what is a lot, what is too much? These things are always sort of nebulous, but if it feels like a lot, then it's bad, and we need the federal government to do something in response. And so not every single provision in this order that he released is actually terrible, but by and large, this is just this is a marker of the Biden administration's sensibility that big corporations in particular are bad and need to be reined in, and that the federal government is the operator that needs to be tasked with saying, hey, you big corporations, you're big. Big is bad. Too big is very bad. Let's not do that.
Catherine, but they do the occupational licensing. That's good, yep. Right?
There are a couple of good things in here.
So, I mean, there's this weird definition of competition, which sometimes means competition, like, hey, it would be cool if people could not have to like get occupationally licensed in a bunch of dumb stuff in a bunch of different states in a bunch of dumb ways, but also means the opposite of competition. It means like this is the like Joe Biden puts his thumb on the scale in a variety of industries in a like not market destroying, but also not good way. And that's all the stuff that Peter just described. I actually just wanted to talk about the nutrition label for internet services because that also caught my eye as like what?
Yeah, how much potassium is in Comcast?
Yeah, but
I even noticed that was weird. Yeah, go on.
I'm waiting for the food pyramid for the internet.
Yeah, but have I ever told you guys about the time at Take Your Daughter to Work Day that I met one of the people involved in the nutrition label, in its original revamp?
Were you the daughter?
I was the daughter. So my mom worked in public health, and she took me to a conference, and at this conference, I was like introduced to some lady who asked me, did I look at nutrition labels? And I was like, no, I find them confusing and they don't make any sense to me. And my mom was like, okay, that's good enough. Because of course it was the person who had just redesigned the nutrition labels. So I assume that that's how it's going to go for nutrition labels for the internet. Also, like, having more information is good. I am deeply skeptical, just as a broad principle, of when people say, like, this is just about information. It's not a regulation. It's not a mandate. It's just like people deserve to have information. It is always actually a thumb on the scale. It is always actually when we, you know, were having the big fight years ago about menu labeling. Remember where we were going to have to put all the calories on all the menu boards and there was a big fuss. And, you know, that sharing of information is always in the service of some kind of policy goal. In that case, it was just like the war on fast food, which was a thing that has now largely passed, I guess. Nutrition label for internet services is not going to make internet better. I'm just going to go ahead and put that hard prediction out there.
You know, one of the things in the executive order where he talks about this, or the fact sheet at whitehouse.gov, it opens by saying the economy is booming under President Biden's leadership. And that's why it needs to be regulated more and more.
Yeah, we had to change everything about it.
Second paragraph, he says, you know, corporate consolidation has been accelerating. In 75% of U.S. industries, a smaller number of large companies now control more of the business than they did 20 years ago. That's a very specious statistic. But then they say this is true across healthcare, financial services, agriculture, and more. And it's like he should have thrown in education, too. But it's like it's telling that the sectors of the economy that they talk about consolidation happening are all things that are either completely or mostly controlled by the federal government. You know, but the economy is booming, et cetera. And this, along with the curse of bigness, where it's just an attack on any company that's bigger than great Tim Wu or Elizabeth Warren think it should be, channeling Louis Brandeis. The other side of that is that now we are no longer going to be talking about how does an industry treat consumers. because that has been the gold standard of all kinds of antitrust and business regulation. Are consumers better off? And you've got to get the consumers off the stage for this type of regulation. In the same way, Kennedy assassination freaks have to get rid of Lee Harvey Oswald because, you know, he screws up everybody's perfect model. And the fact is like, if you're looking at consumer outcomes and consumer health, you know, things change differently. And consolidation, federal regulation, all of these types of things take a back seat to just figuring out, you know, do people have more and better, cheaper, varied choices? And the fact of the matter is that like the size of the firms in an industry are not particularly highly linked to that.
And so, let's also add consumer
status. There's a lot of antitrust in this. And the antitrust comes, you know, with Khan and with Tim Wu, but also, you know, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren, Nick, and this is Biden adopting a sort of Warrenite viewpoint when it comes to big corporations in a lot of ways, and basically saying we are going to use the antitrust toolkit, right? There is a bit here where the order also encourages the leading antitrust agencies to focus enforcement efforts on problems in key markets. Basically, figure out what you can do on antitrust. It is an open-ended order to all federal bureaucrats to see how far they can take antitrust in the age of big tech companies. And it's going to be bad for consumers because they have explicitly said that they want to give up the standard that has governed antitrust law for at least 40 years now, which is, does this hurt consumers? If not, it's not a problem. And that's a crazy standard to give up on, because that's the correct question. Are consumers actually being hurt? And so literally, if you are a consumer out there, what the Biden administration wonks, right, what their sort of philosophy of antitrust is saying is, hey, we actually don't care about your welfare. And Tim Wu has said explicitly at times, well, I think, you know, probably this means that consumers are just going to end up having to pay more. And he has kind of nodded along and suggested, at the possibility that maybe, you know, there would be fewer choices, right? And so that's the end result of this, is that they're going to go to war on bigness for its own sake, and not in order to help ordinary people and consumers, understanding from the outset that it is quite likely to make their lives worse.
We'll probably have some more to say about biggie, techie, and all that kind of stuff. I would add also just that in addition to consumer welfare, there's also the consumer, expressed satisfaction. Like, everyone's going after Amazon, and everyone actually who uses Amazon loves it. That's one of the reasons why Amazon's successful.
And, yeah, and it's people in Congress, which has, you know, had like single digit approval ratings for much of the past 20 years, are leading the charge on Amazon, which has among the highest approval ratings.
Our colleague Liz Wolf wrote a great piece on Jeff Bezos stepping down from his top role at Amazon that was just built around Bezos' whole theory of Amazon is, hey, we should do literally whatever we can to make customers happy, and then they'll like us
he
and
must
use our
be
services.
Stopped.
And that's it. And that's it. And that's how he became a the richest man in the world, and a guy who gets to go to space on his own awesome rocket, is because his theory was, we're going to do what's best for customers. And sometimes his competitors got outcompeted, and yet his competitors are right. Like, it, this is, you know, that's it, that is in many ways what is driving a bunch of the antitrust push and the sort of the movement to rethink what antitrust is for, is that competitors who lose out to Jeff Bezos when Jeff Bezos says, hey, what I want to do is serve customers better than anyone else, and that is how I will win customers. It's that competitors don't always like that. And so a bunch of this is about serving competing businesses rather than making the world better for consumers.
All right, we're going to get to our email of the week here in a second. But first, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp Online Therapy. No matter who you are or what you're doing, your life is probably full of stress. Well, you can unload the stressors and receive some unbiased feedback about your management of that stress from BetterHelp.com. BetterHelp is the customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with a professional counselor, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start your first session within 48 hours. Reason Roundtable listeners get 10% off their first month by going to betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's H-E-L-P, like what England needs with its whole penalty kick strategy thing. Go to betterhelp.com/roundtable today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, send your emails to roundtable@reason.com via email. This one comes from Mike. This one comes from Mike from Williamsburg, Virginia, who writes, "Good morning, big fan of the pod." Thank you, Mike. I have a question that I think Peter will love. It doesn't say anything about the MCU, Mike, so forget it. If you look at U.S.'s COVID response, the moralistic core was that those of very low risk from it, healthy people under 50, kids, were expected to have their lives derailed to protect those who were of higher risk, the unhealthy and the old. This trade-off came with significant consequences to livelihoods and education of primarily younger Americans and largely went unquestioned in the media. What lessons can we take from this as we stare down the barrel of entitlement insolvency? Will the unquestioned morality be that the young must pay the taxes or higher interest rates to make sure retirees maintain their standard of living? Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I think the MCU is a Ponzi scheme. And
you did this, Matt.
Yep, you did this. And the whole point of the MCU is never to actually placate or satisfy you with the particular thing you are watching. It is always to lure you along and set you up for the next thing, which will do the same thing, which sets you up for the next thing. And that is exactly how our entitlement system works.
Okay, there it
is. That is exactly how our entitlement system works, which is that it is, and I say this on the podcast all the time, and I try to tell people this all the time, and unless they're policy professionals, they will like hear you, and they just don't believe it. Social Security is not you putting away money for your retirement. It is not. When you pay Social Security taxes, that is a transfer directly from you, from your paycheck, to current retirees. You have absolutely no right legally to any of that money. All of that money just goes to pay for today's Social Security checks. And when you are a retired person, if you become a retired person, then you will not be getting your Social Security money back. In fact, the amounts that you pay in versus the amounts that you are likely to get out don't add up at all on average for most people. And that is why there is a giant gap in future funding. This is true for Social Security and it is true for Medicare. And this is a thing that we sort of don't really reckon with when these policy debates happen, is that we are not, in fact, creating a system where retirees save for themselves. What we are doing is charging today's workers to subsidize the lifestyle of today's seniors and retirees. And that is one of the reasons why today's seniors are, I believe, the wealthiest cohort by most traditional measures, at least by age. And so what we've done is just say, look, today's workers, you have to subsidize this. But that doesn't work with the population changes that we've seen. This is why some people are concerned about demographics and about the birth dearth and that sort of thing. And it's also just, our politicians have in many ways sold, not quite a lie, but a false impression about how this program works and about how entitlements are going to keep working. And there's just been sort of a huge lack of thought, especially over the past 5 years, given to what we are going to do in 2026 when Medicare starts becoming insolvent in one of its major trust funds. And that's going to happen in Medicare first, and then it's going to happen in Social Security. And as far as I can tell, the push is then going to be from there to not to actually reform the programs, but just to find some additional source of revenue to further offset them and kick the can down the road.
Oh, and the clear front runner, because when the Social Security trust funds are exhausted, Social Security can only pay out in benefits what it takes in a given year. And so depending on the particular fluctuation in the economy, means somewhere between about 20 to 30% of current benefits won't be able to be paid out. What will happen, and Congress probably won't do anything until the very last minute, they're going to up the cap on salary, on income that is subjected to Social Security taxes. They'll also do the same thing. They'll increase the rate on FICA. This is what Ronald Reagan did in the late 80s on the back of other tax cuts. He went along with a plan to massively upgrade the level of payroll taxes and actually proclaimed, you know, that this was the greatest accomplishment of his presidency, that the New Deal, or rather Social Security and Medicare, were the final act of the New Deal. And he had secured funding for them for another generation, which was pretty much true. And then it was Al Gore in the 2000 election. He was the last one to actually, you know, all people may remember his, you know, insistent discussion of lockboxes. Was actually trying to change the kind of funding, you know, and it's more an accounting mechanism for Social Security, to actually try and keep it limited to actual Social Security as opposed to general revenue, which he failed at and nobody wants to do because it's a big pot of money. So we're pretty much screwed on that.
Yeah, Catherine. I mean, just real quick, what that shows you is that those shortfalls that you see in entitlements are implicit tax hikes waiting for us, right?
Right.
Either that or they are reductions in expected benefits, but they're basically implicit tax hikes. And the other thing about the Social Security tax that they are definitely going to lift the cap on at some point in the next 15 years is, when you talk to folks on the center left who want to expand a bunch of government programs, that's always the thing that they go to pay for the thing they want to do.
That money has been spent a lot of times.
It can only pay for one thing. Yes, you could do that, and it would probably raise a bunch of additional money.
And the thing it's going to pay for is Social Security benefits. Like, that's what it's going to pay for. Yeah.
Catherine, Nick has been trying to wage or ignite a generational war.
I want to be the John Brown of generational warfare. Yeah. I want, you know, where's the Harper's Ferry that we can rate?
I think you're insufficiently religious is the problem, Nick.
That's right,
but he's been trying to do that. But in the spirit of Mike's question here, Catherine, which is like, is there going to be sort of a morality imposed on the youngins about this? Eat your Wheaties. The youngins, they're kind of socialistic, right? Like, they're going to be volunteering for this, won't they? Like, is there any hope for Nick's generational war? Fair, given the lay of the land?
I think the most charitable interpretation of events here is to say, listen, as a society, we are becoming more and more sensitive to the plight of the least well-off. And that is reflected in a lot of things in our policies, including massive amounts of risk aversion, right? So we worry about vulnerable people, whether it's race, whether it's age, in both directions, the very young and the very old, whether it's gender. And so we are trying to build a society where those vulnerable people are safer and more secure. And that's a good thing. That like reflects a positive growth for humanity, which historically has been like, oh, are you weak? Well, here's a nice flow. See ya. And so, you know, I think that's the nice interpretation. And that is where the kind of vaguely socialistic youths are coming from. Hey, we should take care of people is like a perfectly good, reasonable sentiment to have. Unfortunately, this is what we were talking about earlier with the kind of like zero sum thinking, or to put it differently, a kind of static versus dynamic thinking. If you imagine that there's a big pot of money and that pot of money is basically fixed, then you might say, hey, we're going to give more of that money to old people. We need to do that because that's the promise we made them, or because they need it, or whatever. And that includes, you know, that sort of all this discussion of wealth taxes. You know, it's not just the income-based pot of money. Maybe we need to go after people's assets. But what that misses is that it's, you know, money in the hands of younger people, and also money in the hands, frankly, of richer people. Like, that's the money that pays for innovation. That's the money that is used to make more money and more things and make life better. And to build rockets. And to lose sight of that is extremely dangerous. And, you know, the uncharitable interpretation is like, we live in a parasitic gerontocracy where the olds will bleed the youngs dry and have no remorse about it because they are going to take all the money and then die impoverished and screw you guys. And that I think is also a fair interpretation of events and certainly the way that much of our politics has gone. Yes, I think in answer to the question, we are the lesson of COVID is absolutely a parallel to entitlement insolvency, and that scares the bejesus out of me.
The flip side of this, and people like Lawrence Kotlikoff, a Boston University economist, who talks a lot, he's trying to start generational warfare. He also points out, you know, that the entitlements, the old age entitlements, which is most entitlements, is a racket and it's totally screwing over young people. By the same token, boomers have something like $68 trillion. This was before COVID. So it's probably double that now because most of it's in the stock market, but they have $68 trillion in holdings. Most of that is going to kick down to younger people as their parents eventually die or, you know, have accidents where they, you know, somehow they wake up dead because there's a bunch of My Pillows, you know, on top of them by their children who just happen to be visiting for the weekend or something. So it gets complicated quickly. And I think one of the big educational projects for Reason and everybody else is to get through to younger people, because they're the ones who are going to be the change makers on this, is that there are poor people and then there are like a lot of decent off and well off people. And these are very different populations. The fact of the matter is that I think the people who end up making policy tend to come from the upper third, if not the upper quintile of income. And they think they grew up poor, generally speaking, and that they need as much help as somebody living in a fucking ghetto or in a housing project or in Section 8 housing on Medicaid. And we really need to kind of say, you know what, there are people in need and the government can and should help them effectively. And the rest of us, we should, you know, we should be paying for a smaller government that does things better. And, you know, you coming out of an Ivy League education or, you know, a flagship research state university with $15,000 in debt that your parents are picking up anyway, and they're still paying for your fucking cell phone plan when you're 30, that is not poverty. And that's not what the government isn't here to alleviate your stress. But
I think the frame that Nick is pointing towards, which is one that we've talked about at Reason over the years, is like it's entitlements or it's safety net. You got to pick one. There's a feeling of magical thinking right now when it comes to all things government spending and long term this and that and money printer go burr. At some point, that choice is going to have to be made. And there's a lot of implications about that. But if you really want to help people via a safety net, entitlements are going to brokey McPoverty your way or your ability to do
really?
That was a verb.
Do you have to Irishize?
That was a hate crime.
Haven't they suffered enough?
I mean, the thing that is different about, like, if there is a single change to kind of wonkish political discourse in the last 5 years, it is that people no longer acknowledge that there are trade-offs like the one you just described. That there are many, many people who now say, no, you absolutely don't have to choose between safety net and old age entitlements. You can. And then the answer is a combination of, as Peter said, we're going to like spend that money when we raise the cap on the Social Security. Like, that's a lot of money. That money is going to pay for everything. Also, we're going to take all of Jeff Bezos's money, like him personally, and money printer go burr. And like those three things mean that scarcity is over when it comes to government spending. And that belief was always looming, even before people had a slightly smarter, or I guess we'll say more clever, articulated version of why we didn't have to make hard choices. The desire to not make hard choices has always been there. People have always denied the actual fact of hard choices. Republicans, of course, do this and like, we're going to eliminate waste and abuse and then have all the money for the forever wars. But that type of argumentation has gotten so much worse. And I fear that the result will be, as I just said, that we end up bleeding dry the most productive, most innovative individuals and sectors of the economy to try and make that fiction a reality.
There's a working paper out of the Hoover Institution recently that finds that if Joe Biden's family's plan were to pass, it would add about 6 million households to federal entitlement rolls and that would result in the percentage of non-elderly American households, so that's not senior homes, receiving entitlements past the 50% mark. So majority of prime age working households would be receiving some sort of federal benefit. What we are not solving the looming entitlement crises that we have. We are instead
shoveling more humans into the looming entitlement crisis. Also, the phrase soft infrastructure makes me so sad. Like, that's a thing we're just saying now? Soft infrastructure?
Because it's made of Nerf.
Jeff Bezos' rocket is not soft infrastructure. Let's go to our end of podcast. What you have been consuming. Do you want to lead us off, Peter Suderman?
Oh, yeah. I watched Black Widow. It's another installment in the MCU Ponzi scheme. You know, it's totally fine. I really like Scarlett Johansson and David Harbour, who are great in this. And it's just totally fine and not really any better than that. And it's sort of weird how this movie, it is on the one hand, the first big solo outing for a big Marvel character. And on the other hand, also a sort of a dead end. Yes, there is. This is not that much of a spoiler, a sort of a soft setup for someone who might take the mantle of Black Widow. But it's like this movie just sort of happens midway through the MCU timeline. And of course, if you've followed the MCU films, and here are spoilers for a 2-year-old movie, don't at me. Don't. Black Widow dies in the last Avengers movie. And like, so we've now got a big solo outing for a character who's dead and kind of can't go anywhere. And it's just not enough, and especially not enough in comparison with what the MCU has been doing on streaming, and in particular with Loki, which we can talk about more next
every
week.
Day,
next
all week. The days.
After episode 6 is run.
Nick, what non-Loki have you been consuming?
So I have been watching, I stumbled into this a couple of weeks ago. I have a Roku streaming device, and Roku has its own channels where it's pumping out. Like, you know, what is great is the, you know, the streaming universe is like a garbage pail. It's like everything that has ever been on TV anywhere, anytime is somewhere out there. And it's just a question. I was talking with an old friend of mine who used to work at AOL in the late aughts as it was shutting down. And he's pretty sure there are still whole divisions of AOL, like cities and like specific things that are still going on. Like they're like Japanese soldiers on islands in the Pacific. You know, there's just whole universes, whole worlds that are still going on as they haven't gotten the news that things have changed. So Roku, their originals programming, a lot of it is actually old Quibi shows. Quibi was the top-down last gasp attempt by Hollywood, really. It got ultimately like $2 billion in investment to do shows where episodes were no longer than 5 to 10 minutes, because they were like, you know, people want to watch stuff on their phone and they're with, you know, super slow, low attention spans. So we're going to do everything in 5 to 10 minute chunks. It was a complete failure. One of the shows that Roku is now streaming is called Murder House Flip, which is a rehab show where a designer and like an architect go to a house where a murder has been committed, and they redo part of the house so the people feel more comfortable living there. And it's kind of like, you know, it's like a parody of a rehab, of a house rehab show. And it's kind of glorious to watch, because this is where top-down Hollywood entertainment kind of went to die. It's like the most ridiculous version of the entire, you know, 100+ years of Hollywood thinking that their audience are idiots.
The two founders kind of Quibi were Jeff Katzenberg, who is like an old Disney hand, and Meg Whitman, who ran for governor of California.
And who was a principal at eBay for a long time. Katzenberg, of course, what's fascinating, he helped kind of usher in the new resurgence of Disney as an animated feature film, you know, powerhouse. And he left to form DreamWorks SKG because he got passed over for Disney. But like, you know, so within the past 50 years, he was a major success, but he's so out of touch. I highly, recommend watching all of the Quibi shows that are on Roku, including The Most Dangerous Game, a 50-minute version of a 100-year-old story that doesn't even get to the action until halfway through. The thing that people are waiting for.
But it stars a Hemsworth.
It does. It has one of the Hemsworth, and it could have all three. They might be like the Olsen twins, where they all have, you know, they can only work 6 hours at a time or something, so they swap them in. But there's a show that hasn't come out yet that was a Quibi show that's supposed to come out on Roku called 50 States of Fright, and it's an anthology show where there's like horror episodes for each state in the country. And the first one is called The Golden Arm, and it stars the magnificent or marvelous Mrs. Maisel as a woman who has a golden arm that is killing her, but she refuses to give it up. And the trailers for it are hilarious. And that's the thing to keep on. But go watch Murder House Flip on Roku, and you will see where Hollywood went to die.
Catherine, what kind of Hemsworth swapping have you been doing?
Okay, so I, first of all, am, as you know, never going to buy a house, but the one exception I would make to that is I would buy a murder house because I don't,
know, often
I'm not
bargains.
Superstitious, and yeah. So it would be a great bargain. So if there's like blood stains, like do call me to just to see if I'm interested in the sale. What I'm consuming this month is, or this week is giant pandas who are no longer endangered. You guys,
you're not actually eating them.
That actually was, thank you for stepping on my joke, friends. I was
going
to say that I am hoping to someday actually consume a panda. I know that right now they're still vulnerable and so we don't have them for snacks yet, but I absolutely...
Vat-grown panda meat.
Looking forward to the day when I can have a panda kebab. And we got one step closer today because they are off the endangered species list. China figured out somehow how to get pandas in the mood. Because the whole problem with pandas was that they would not make baby. Like, even though there were pandas and they were around, it was like pandas were not good at the sex somehow. And so I don't know what China did. They figured it out. I am very interested in what is going to happen to what is like kind of a, I don't know if it's a, maybe it's a Ponzi scheme. Like, pandas have been the face of the environmental movement's efforts to restore endangered species, right? Like, it's the logo of the World Wildlife Fund. They are the ultimate charismatic megafauna, and they always have been. And people love to give money for pandas because they're cute and cuddly and whatever. I went to the National Zoo for the first time last weekend in a long time. And like the pandas are still like the champagne room of the zoo. Like there's like a VIP lounge where you have to like jump online to get the tickets from the QR code. It's ridiculous. So artificial panda scarcity is going to have to end pretty soon at the zoo as well as at my lunch. And when that happens, though, I'm interested, like, what are they going to start fundraising against? Like, they're going to need something cute and endangered, and because people aren't going to give money to save, like, three-toed frogs that live in a particular kind of wetland. Like, they have long shown that that is just not what they drop the cash for. But it's going to be harder and harder to claim that the pandas need your money because those guys are thriving.
I'm curious, just are there policy lessons here? Like countries are trying to increase their birth rates. Was there like a successful child tax credit for panda babies?
I mean, there is a situation here where, so China did this, right? And so I think we should be very freaking careful to look to China for any lessons about childbearing, panda bearing, bear bearing. We should not. China is not the place to look. I think they succeeded in this narrow case, but I would not like to draw broader lessons.
I think that rule of three requires that if Catherine's going to have a podcast in which it starts with private rockets, includes panda snacks, that you should probably just say something about not voting, just to kind of like just to click off all of the boxes.
Yeah.
Here, Catherine.
I do not vote. There you go.
Okay, there you go. Thank you. What I've been consuming is from last night onward, just mashing the hashtag SOS Cuba on Twitter. There have been the most anti-government demonstrations in Cuba that we've seen in at least 27 years since 1994. And the 1994 ones were mostly just in Havana. These have been all over the country. They started yesterday. They've been really, really inspiring and thrilling and nerve-wracking because the state is an authoritarian police state with lots of scary-looking resources and they're starting to put down some of the protests, and you hear gunshots, and there's a committee for the defense of the revolution on literally every block on every street in Cuba. So the police state there is incredible. So the amount of courage being shown by people to demonstrate, and there's also the capacity in America, the limitless capacity of people to say stupid things about all of this. I would recommend trying to ignore that as much as possible and just be sympathetic and empathetic and look at people trying to challenge their government and keep them in your thoughts and hopefully not in your policy necessarily, unless that policy is to lift all the stupid restrictions on Americans traveling or sending money there and other stupid aspects of the embargo that Donald Trump restored. But it's just it's amazing to watch these protests, and I hope it turns out well, and I really, really fear that it does not. That's all the pessimism or fraught anxiety that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcasts. Listen to all our stuff. Someone sent us an email saying, or a tweet saying, that they feel like the endings are too abrupt and we need some outro music. So as we go in this, we should imagine.
You got your keyboard right there, buddy.
I got
But you I'd have to be able to theme play to Frasier.
I've never watched that television.
I think that would be a nice outro
program.
Music about tossed salads and scrambled eggs.
Remember is that from the Cheers episode when Frasier came back after failing to propose marriage to Diane. The greatest joke was that now in Italy, they call when someone misses a kick in soccer and just whiffs, they call that a Frasier. Mm-hmm. And I've been using that ever since.
Yeah. So, what do they call that in England, Matt, to be a little bit more topical?
They call that Tuesday.
Yeah, that's right. They call that the EU Cup final.
That's all the soccer we have time for. Listen to all our podcasts, read.com podcast. Goodbye.